Good evening, everyone. This is Gil Student, our Torah in Motion. Let's get started now, and as people come in over time, they'll catch up with us. Tonight, this is, I believe, the fifth of our series of eight classes on Torah in Motion. And I'd like to thank everybody who's come so far and will come in the future, and Torah in Motion, of course, for hosting us and giving us this great technology that lets us do this from the comfort of our homes. Tonight, if you follow what my announcement on my blog yesterday, when I told people what we're going to talk about tonight, I announced that I'm going to be giving my grand theory of reconciling Torah and science. So wait for it. We'll get to it by the end of the evening. But first, we need to discuss some recent Jewish books, which is the topic of our classes. Now, the whole idea of Torah and science being in conflict is itself not 100% intuitive. You might think that, well, how could that be? Could never be. And then there's a good reason for that. But before we get to that, I'm sorry, let me just read off the booklet that we have up here. The first one is called The Religion and Science Debate, Why Does It Continue? Edited by Harold Attridge from Yale University Press. Came out this year, 2009. The second one is Gerald Schroeder, Genesis and the Big Bang. Came out in 1991. It's an old book. He's already published, I think, at least three books beyond that. I stopped counting after I stopped buying them. number three, Rabbi Nathan Slifkin's The Challenge of Creation. I believe Rabbi Slifkin is giving two other classes in this series of Torah and Moshe lectures. But then we're going to be talking about a lot more than just his book. And number four, Rabbi Chaim Navon, Genesis and Jewish Thought, which was published last year by Ketav in collaboration with Yeshivat Har Zion, which hosted the original email classes that led to this book. Now, we're talking about Torah and science conflict. And some of the things that we're going to discuss tonight is, what is science? What is Torah? Can they conflict? And if so, what do we do about it? As believers in Torah, and perhaps believers in science, as we'll discuss. So if there is a conflict between these two truths, or these two sources of truth, then we have to deal with that somehow. And how do we deal with that? There are multiple ways, which we'll be discussing tonight, and at which the end, we'll get to, like I said, my grand theory of reconciling Torah and science. Now, one reaction you might have is that there can't be any conflict between Torah and science, because all science is in Torah. And I believe, now again, we have handouts that you can download on the bottom right in the file share. But I will be loading them up here on the screen. Here we go, number seven. Okay. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, Hapochba, Hapochba, Dekulaba. And Bag Bag Omer. In the office, the secretary near me has that set up to the ringer of her cell phone. There's a song, a tune to that Mishnah, so I hear it a few times every day. So, Ben Bag Bag Omer. Hapochba, Hapochba, Dekulaba. Turn it, meaning learn it again and again, because everything is in it, meaning the Torah. Everything is in the Torah. Everything's in the Torah. What does that include? It includes science, includes math, includes biology, includes chemistry, includes physics, includes everything, art, every possible knowledge that humans can acquire, that's in the Torah, and maybe even some more that we can't acquire, that's hidden in there and we just don't know about it. Now, from this mission, we see two things. Number one, we see that all you have to do is study Torah, and you'll learn everything you need to know about the world. And the second is that if that's true, if that's the case, if all you have to do is study Torah and you'll learn everything you need to know about the world, then anything we can possibly learn about the world, which includes science, cannot contradict what's in the Torah. How could it? Because science is in the Torah. But that might be the way we learned it originally when we were in yeshiva as little kids, but when you look into the commentaries, you see that's not necessarily the way that they learned it. I have up on the screen different approaches from the Midrash Shmuel. The Midrash Shmuel is a 16th century commentary on Pirkei Avos, and because it's in the 16th century, it was written after the time of the Rishonim, and the editor collected all of the different, or many, many, many of the different commentaries that were written before him, that he had all before him, the Rambam, Rashi, Abarbanel, Meiri, all the great stuff, plus many more, including his own original insights. He collected them all. So there you have Kolbo, Ashita Mikubentes, of all the different approaches and comments on Pirkei Avos. And so he has five different, or let's at least look at five different explanations he has of this mission. And number one is that everything in the world has a part of God in it. Dekulabah, I mean God, part of God is in everything, but the Torah has all of God in it. And therefore, Torah is endless because God is infinite. Now that is a very deep, profound, philosophical, or Kabbalistic approach, Kabbalistic statement, which frankly I don't claim to understand, but it is definitely does not mean, it does not have anything to do with science. Number two, Hapo, can you hear me? All the rewards in this world and the next are obtained through Torah. I mean, Kulabah, everything that you would want can be gotten through Torah, so that's why you should continue learning it, because that's the way you will get everything that you want in Olam Hazeh and in Olam Haba. Again, nothing about science. A third approach within this Midrash Shmuel is that all views on every Torah matter are contained within the Torah. So if you have a question or you don't understand a particular Gemara, keep learning Torah, and eventually you'll find the opinions that address your question and that or that resonate with you. So keep learning, even if you find a difficult Gemara and you don't like all the approaches that you see to it, keep learning, and eventually you come up with an approach that that appeals to you. A fourth is you can't understand Torah until you first raise problems with it. Then you resolve them, you go into the Torah, you turn it. The fifth is that all answers about the Torah are in it somewhere, meaning the Torah is poor in one place, rich in another place. It's another statement from the sages. So if you read a passage, you don't understand it, keep learning. Eventually, as you go through the entire Talmud, you go through all the Midrashim, eventually you'll find an answer to it. The answer is somewhere within Torah. Torah is a self-contained unit. Again, none of this has anything to do with science. What I'm trying to draw out here is that according to all these explanations, it's not necessarily that if you learn Torah, you'll understand science. That's not what the Mishnah is saying at all. It's saying other important ideas that have nothing to do with science. And if you think about it, does it really appeal to you? Does it make sense to you that if you learn Torah, you will understand science? If you ever take a college-level physics class, do you think you could understand any of those equations, any of those ideas, even just by learning Gemara? I took college-level physics. I have never found anything like that in the Gemara, and I don't think that you can. Nuclear physics, you're going to find that while learning Torah? I find it very unlikely to believe that. If you just learn Torah, you will therefore understand nuclear physics. Come on, I mean, let's be realistic here. It's not going to happen. But let's move on and to a different approach which might explain everything and take us from a different perspective, and that's the approach of the Rambam. The Rambam definitely believed that everything is in the Torah. However, not everything in the Torah necessarily stayed with the Jewish people. The Torah was given at one point in time at Mount Sinai, and as it was transmitted over time, a lot of it was lost, a lot of it was forgotten. Moshe kibel Torah miSinai, uMisara liYehoshua. So some of them say Moshe kibel, he received everything from God at Sinai, but then he misaruha liYehoshua. Yeshua was the Canaan, but he passed it on. Yeshua didn't receive all of it because Moshe couldn't transmit all of it, and some of it was lost in the transmission. And we actually see this. Chazal could tell us that in the Avelus, in the mourning period for Moshe, so Klal Yisrael, they forgot many halachos, and it was only Osniel ben Kenaz who retrieved it through using the methodologies of Talmudic methodologies from which we derive laws from the Torah. So we see things were lost through the transmission through time, even in the times right after Moshe died, things were lost, and certainly years after that, beyond that, and then that's the Rambam's approach, that all of philosophy and all of science in his time was originally known as part of the Torah and is encompassed in the Torah, but it was lost over time. And if you learn Gemara, you won't understand the philosophy. However, if you study philosophy and then you look back in the Torah, you can read that philosophy back into the Torah, and now that you know it, now that you know the science, when you look at the Torah, you can see it there. And this is something we're going to talk about, we're going to come back to in a few moments later tonight. That this approach of the Rambam is something that contemporaries are doing. And we'll see what we can do with that and how we can understand that. I just want to move to, before we actually begin, some of the different approaches to reconciling Torah and science, something that I was taught, and I found it actually in a book. So let me put it up on the board here. And, you know, the truth is, you've probably heard this before, and you've seen it in different places. Here's one place, The Eye of the Needle, is a book we talked about a few weeks ago, an outreach book, when we had our class about the different approaches to outreach. So talking about an anti-science approach, what would turn people off from Judaism is the idea that Orthodox Judaism is backwards and it's anti-science. So the book says, this perception evolved as a result of Christianity's historical hostility to science. One of the most famous displays of this closed-mindedness occurred when Galileo discovered that the Earth revolved around the Sun and not the other way around. Galileo's finding was censored by the Vatican because it conflicted with Christian doctrine. Unfortunately, Judaism has historically been lumped together with Christianity in the popular mind as being anti-science and anti-reason, meaning the Catholic Church was a major power in the medieval world, and in order to hold on to that power, it pushed down, it was anti-science, which was trying to challenge it. And it's unfair to think of Judaism as being as anti-science, as reactionary to science, as Christianity was. Now, this is probably true because Judaism was never in power and never had those challenges to that extent, certainly not in the past 2,000 years. But to say that Judaism was pro-science when it was just a church who was not, is not entirely accurate historically. So let's think about when Copernicus came out. Here's a picture of Copernicus for your pleasure. The whole idea that instead of the Earth revolving around the and the Sun revolving, the whole universe revolving around the Earth, that the Earth revolves around the Sun. So this was actually opposed by the biggest Talmidei Chachamim to deal with science in that time. So, for example, who were the big Talmidei Chachamim in that time? The Maharal, Chacham David Nieto, he was a rabbi in London at the beginning of the 1700s. Rabbi David Gans, who was a Talmid, he was a student of the Maharal, and he was himself very familiar with astronomy. He was also opposed to the views of Copernicus. The Maaseh Tovia by Rabbi Tovia Katz was also opposed to the ideas of Copernicus. They too believe, and why? Because it says in Yehoshua, this is one of many places in Tanakh, it says in Yehoshua, Shemesh be'Givon Dom, the sun should stand still during the battle that was taking place. In Givon, the sun should stay in place until the battle was done. They wanted it to be day until they finished the battle, and it was reaching sunset. So they commanded the sun should stay still and should not move around the earth. And it did until the battle finished, and only then did the sun set. So it seems from this verse, the whole passage, that the sun revolves around the earth and not the earth around the sun. And because of that contradiction, they said, well, Copernicus must be wrong. The sun clearly revolves around the earth. It's clear in the Bible that the sun revolves around the earth. And it's a conflict between Torah and science. Science loses. Goodbye, Copernicus. Now, we all know, hopefully most of us know, that the earth does in fact revolve around the sun. And these rabbis who reacted negatively to Copernicus were in fact wrong on a scientific level. And the way we deal with the verses that they came up with in the Bible is we reinterpret it. It's actually not very difficult at all to reinterpret. If you look in the commentaries, they all discuss it. It's not even something that we have to raise because it's so obvious to us, to all of us who were raised in the 20th century, that of course the earth revolves around the sun. But what we do see is that Judaism is conservative, and I think that's a good thing. It's conservative in many ways. We don't give up the farm very easily. Whenever there's a new scientific theory, we don't automatically give into it. Whenever there's a new social fad, we don't give into it immediately. We're conservative. We don't want to change until we know for sure that we have to change, even if it's something that doctrinally, that dogmatically, that based on our belief system, it doesn't really make a huge difference. That's not the point here. The point we're discussing is not whether when you had Torah at that point in the early 1700s and the late 1600s, when you had Torah conflicting with science, was it a big conflict that they couldn't reinterpret the Torah to fit the science? That wasn't even the issue, from my perspective at least. The issue was, you have some new theory coming along, do we want to just jump at it and reinterpret our parts of our religion just for that. And the same thing with social fads also, psychological fads, psychiatric fads. Just because a new theory comes along doesn't mean we have to jump at it. I personally, and I think that's very good, that we are conservative about it. We take our time. We wait to see, does it have staying power? Many theories are overthrown very quickly. There was a philosophical theory in the, I don't remember exactly, 20s or 30s, that basically proposed that anything, any statement that cannot be proven is meaningless. And based on that, they immediately threw out all of religion. You can't prove it. You can't prove God's existence, which we'll, Amir Sashem will discuss in about 2 weeks. You can't prove this or that, this statement or that statement, metaphysics, the afterlife, then it's meaningless, not even worth discussing. And that took the world by storm for a while, until maybe 10 years later, someone said, wait a second, the whole premise that unless you can prove something it's meaningless cannot be proven. And then, with that one kasha, with that one question, they overturned that entire philosophical school, and it just died out after that, because it just didn't make sense. Now, if we follow every fad that comes along, like that fad there, and there are many other fads that come along, you know, you can't just change your religion, even if it's not a major belief, even if it's a totally ancillary belief. We don't just want to change things, or even practice, we don't want to change things. Conservatism, from my perspective at least, I believe is a very good thing. And that's how I look at the rabbis, the great rabbis, who reacted negatively to Copernicus, is we're not going to start reinterpreting things just because some new theory comes along. Now, again, also, they were at the beginning of the modern period, or getting closer to the modern period, and for them, you know, science had not changed much in hundreds and hundreds of years. For us, we see science changing very often. So on the one hand, we have less certainty in the science that we knew in the past, but we also have less science and less certainty, less confidence, and the new science that comes along, because when is it going to be overthrown? 5 years? 10 years? Where's the principle that tells us that every 5 years, you know, they have a computing, this principle that, I don't even remember what it is, every 6 months, computing power doubles. Well, what's the principle with science? How long does a theory last until it's overturned? You know, and we're going to come back to this. I'm not trying to sound anti-science here, even though it's coming out that way. But let's move on to our first book. Over here. It's called The Religion and Science Debate. Why Does It Continue? Let me tell you a little background about this book and why it's so interesting. This is largely a Christian book. Even though I think there are some Jewish authors, they're writing for the general society, a secular society. And the story behind this book is that a little over 100 years ago, someone donated a lot of money, I think his last name was Terry, donated a lot of money to Yale University to annually hold a lecture series in which a prominent scholar would come to Yale and lecture over a few weeks or a few months on the topic of science and religion. And that usually the series are eventually published into a book. And that went on for decades until the year 2005, when they had the 100th lecture, which is quite an accomplishment. Someone gave money, you know, in the early 1900s, and it's kept going year after year after year. And a lot of very interesting topics have been discussed. So in the 100th year, they changed the format, and instead of bringing one scholar to speak, they brought five different ones. One philosopher, two scientists, a historian, and a sociologist, to discuss why do we even have to continue talking about it after 100 years. And the result was this book. In general, just a little background, I read the whole thing. So one thing you have to realize is that the cards were stacked in this book against intelligent design. They very much didn't like it. So two of the people are actually involved in the anti-intelligent design movement. So the cards are stacked against intelligent design, which is something we'll talk about in two weeks when we talk about the proofs for God's existence. The philosopher is someone very fascinating. His name is Alvin Plantinga. He is the person who, maybe not single-handedly, but pretty close single-handedly, revived the discussion about the proofs for God's existence and brought them beyond the 1700s. He himself is a very fascinating person. But we're not even going to talk about him right now. We're going to talk about two of the articles in there. One by the historian, who gives an interesting background to the whole science and religion debate, Now, really, the science and religion debate is timeless. It's been going on forever, even from the time of Aristotle, when he tried to prove, or he believed he proved, that the world existed forever. There was no creation, and you know, that was a challenge to religion, or at least the religions that believed in creation, like Judaism and later Christianity. And those kinds of disagreements went on for centuries, probably for thousands of years, and throughout that time you had people who tried to reconcile it. You know, in the Middle Ages, perhaps most prominent among Jews was the Rambam, who wrote the whole Mora Nevuchim in order to reconcile Judaism with philosophy. But in the 1700s, the conflict gained a lot of ground, particularly in places of, say, like France, where you had scientists and you had philosophers who were very, very anti-religious. It really went on throughout the world as the Enlightenment increased. Science and the studies, all sorts of academic studies, became very anti-religious. In the U.S., we were a little behind the times, and it didn't really hit us until the 1800s. But in the 1800s, that's when it started gaining steam. And so what was the reaction to that? So one reaction was very interesting. In the year 1833, there was a fellow named Benjamin Silliman. He published a book called Robert Bakewell's Introduction to Geology. That was a standard text on geology, and he published it in the U.S. It was the first U.S. edition, and what he added to it... Now, remember, geology talks about how the world is millions of years old, at least at that time, certainly. So to publish a textbook like that in the U.S. in 1833, that would be considered by some to be anti-religious. But what he did, Benjamin Silliman was a very traditional religious fellow, he added to that standard text, which was unavailable until that time, he added a supplement of over 70 pages where he tried to reconcile geology with the Bible. As a Christian, you know, and for instance, saying that the days of creation were longer than an actual day, they were periods, long extended millions of years periods, and throughout his supplements, now imagine, if the only way you could get a textbook, a standard textbook in geology, anyone in college who's studying geology would have to buy this textbook that had this religious reconciliation added onto that. So that was very controversial. That got a lot of people angry at him. You know, some of the scientists were angry at him, and in fact, one of the religious people, was a linguist, a biblical scholar, was very upset at him. That he even suggested that the day of creation was not a 24-hour day. He suggested that it was longer. So the linguist, you know, stick in your own field. You're a geologist. Don't move into my field, which is you know, the Bible and ancient languages. Now, in truth, I think that biblical scholar was way off. We're not going to talk about it now, but just here's a whole list of different verses throughout the Bible where the word yom, the word day, does not mean a 24-hour period. You know, Vayikra Elokim la'or yom v'lachoshech kara laila. That's in the very beginning of Genesis. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. So when do we see light out? Not 24 hours. And even on an even day, the very most even day possible, so light is out for 12 hours and darkness is out for 12 hours. So you see, yom means 12 hours and laila means 12 hours, at least in that particular context. Later in the verse, vayi erev, vayi boker, yom echad. And then you have the day yom, you have the yom echad, one day, so what does day mean there? If earlier in the verse, it means 12 hours. And there are many other verses where it can mean year, it can mean many years. Yaakov worked for Rachel. They were in his eyes like a few days. It was 7 years. That's more than a few days, it seemed to him. So you see elsewhere that it can mean days. So we're not going to go into that. But from a biblical perspective, there's really no need to say that a day is only 24 hours. I don't know what this biblical scholar was talking about, but just a historical side point today. Last month, or a few weeks ago, was the 150th anniversary of the publication of Darwin's Origin of the Species. So there were a lot of hoopla in the media about that, and there was a republication of that book, Origin of the Species, and I believe the copyright ran out or something like that, so someone is giving out for free on college campuses. Actually, someone famous. If you grew up in the 80s, you probably know who he is. His name is Kirk Cameron. He was an actor in the 80s on the popular sitcom Family Ties. He became fundamentalist Christian. And he, along with some organization, is giving out free copies of Origin of the Species. Well, why would they do that? The fundamentalist Christians, why would they be giving out copies of Origin of the Species? Because tacked on to that book, which is for free, is a whole long supplement contradicting evolution, trying to disprove evolution based on creation and science, which take it as it is. But if you're a college student, you have the choice: either buy it in the college bookstore for however many $50-100, or take one for free with the supplements. You're gonna take the free one, of course. If I was in college, I was thinking of enrolling in college just so I can get a free copy. You know, because you put it on your bookshelf, it's great. But there you have that supplement, which sometime or another you might be interested in, open it up, and you might find it interesting, and that's the whole point. And that's exactly what this guy did in 1833. He tacked on this 70-plus page supplement to the standard Introduction to Geology, harmonizing geology, the million years old perspective on the world, with the Bible. Let's jump ahead a little bit. 1896. Now, throughout the 1800s, there was controversy going on in the U.S. 1896, the president of Cornell College, I don't know if it was university at that point, most of the colleges and universities in the U.S. at that point were religious in some way or another. Cornell was not. Cornell was secular, it was proudly secular, and the president of that college, obviously a prominent scholar, wrote a history of the religion-science conflict. And it was a polemic. It was biased. And he was yelling and screaming in that book, and then he wanted to add... to pour salt on the injury, he went on a speaking tour across the country to promote that, and really to rile up people against religion by saying religion impedes science. And that's what he tries to prove in his book. Now, for all the holes you can poke in his scholarship, if you think about it, there is truth to that, going back to the Middle Ages, where religion did impede science. You know, when you talk about that just in conversation, you speak about that as medieval, because literally is medieval. That's what they did in medieval times. Whenever religion conflicted with science, the scientists were killed, were excommunicated, were tortured until they recanted. Also in the book is a very fascinating article by a sociologist, Robert Withnow, sociologist, I think maybe in Princeton, and he discusses how people reconcile religion and science. He starts off with the idea of both and, meaning you accept religion and you accept science, you accept both, one and the other. But the question is, how do you do that? So the answer is, what people frequently say is religion, well, science is about how the world works, the mechanics of it, and religion is why things work this way, why was this put in this universe this way, why was the universe even created that way, and all the details of the why. Religion is about the spiritual. Science is about the physical. Religion is about why, and science is about how. And you hear this a lot. I personally hear that a lot. I see, last week we talked about Rabbi Yitzhak Echelon and his approach to studying Tanakh. Well, in his book, Between the Lines of the Bible, at one point he does say that also. He says religion is about why, and science is about how. And I remember once at an event I heard Rabbi Shalom Carmi, who was a very prominent Jewish philosopher and Bible scholar, he said it also. Now, the problem with that is, if you take, in general, it works, it's very true, but if you go into specifics, it doesn't work. There are times where science talks about the spiritual, and where religion makes truth claims about the physical world, creation being number one. But even if you don't want to deal with creation, there are many other cases within the Bible, the Exodus from Egypt, that's a truth claim. And there are other truth claims that you can find from religion. So even if in general you could say religion is about why, at some points, they discuss the why of specific events, and you have to deal with that. And the both and doesn't necessarily deal with that. And science also talks about why. There are things like evolutionary psychology, which talks about why people do things, and which really gets into the spiritual. And that is science talking about the why. So there's, on the boundaries of science and religion, the both and doesn't really work. In general, it's a great concept, but it doesn't necessarily work on the boundaries. So Withnow deals with that, and he comes up with what he sees sociologically as being very popular nowadays, and that's a totally different idea, which he critiques, but he points out is not ideal, but it's very common, and that's what he calls a multivocal approach. Yeah, you could say this, or you could say that. I hear that argument, I hear that argument. Meaning you don't come to any decision, you don't come to any conclusion, you just talk about it. You talk about the different points of view, and that's the end of the conversation. So what are you left with? So Wuthno refers to that as multiphrenia, right? We're familiar with the term schizophrenia, which I think is outdated medically, but the term schizophrenia about a split personality. So he talked about multiphrenia, and not in the terms of a disorder, but in terms of a way of life, an approach to the world, of having split personality, multiple personalities based on the different possible, yeah, you can say this, yeah, you can say that, and he brings quotes, he brings testimony from a court trial about intelligent design, where an expert on stand would say, yeah, well, you can say this, and you can say that, I can see this perspective, I can see that perspective, and you can't get to what do you believe? The lawyer was saying, what do you believe? And he said, well, I can hear the argument for this, and I can hear the argument for that. And there are people who live their lives like that, without coming to any conclusion. Now, if that's the way you want to live your life, fine. If this topic doesn't interest you and you don't want to come to any conclusions, fine. That's fine. More power to you. But as an approach to reconciling religion and science, it just doesn't work. It's just not even bothering to put in the effort. There are other ways to look at it, and that's what we're going to discuss now. And through these other ways, we'll eventually come to my grand theory, which I told you about, of reconciling Torah and science. So one of the ways is called concordism. Now, in everything we're about to discuss over the next half hour or so, most of it is contained in Rabbi Natan Slifkin's excellent book, The Challenge of Creation, which I should add I had a large part in bringing it to press. I published it, I did a lot of editing, I was on the day of the launch of the book, which we held a launch in Queens, I was driving around in my car trying to chase down a UPS truck to get the books. That was quite an experience in itself. But I had a large part in this book, so I apologize for advertising it. But it's a fabulous book. It's not just a book about Torah and science. It's a book about philosophy. It's a book about approaches to the world, approaches to the Bible. It's really a fabulous, it's a masterpiece. It's his tour de force, and I feel bad for him because I don't think he can ever top his book, and that's how great it is. Now, if I were just going to tell you what's in the book, you wouldn't even need to listen to me because he's giving two classes on Torah and Moshe. So most of what I'm going to say is based in the book, but we're going to be stepping out from the book and talking about other ideas as well, adding on to what he says in the book based on material that has been published since. It's a 2006 book, so since 2006. But one of the things he talked about is concordism. What is concordism? Concordism is reading science and reading the Bible and trying to make them tie together 100%. Taking the science and reading it into the Bible. So basically, taking the creation story and reinterpreting it based on what you learn from science. And I'll give one example of this, one author, one book, although there's more than one. Genesis and the Big Bang by Dr. Gerald Schroeder. He trained at MIT. He knows quite a bit about physics. And he wrote this book in 1991, 18 years ago, if my math is correct, 19 years ago. Trying to show, really, it's a great book to read because it's very compelling reading. It's a page turner, and he tries to show how the days of creation are billions of years old. So he starts with the idea that the universe is 15 billion years old, and he tries to show how progressively each day got shorter and shorter, maybe in half. I don't remember exactly, but how each day got shorter and shorter, and how it corresponds to part of what science tells us. The universe developed. So on the one hand, he's taking the science, how long the days were and how the universe developed based on science. He's reading it into the Torah, but he's reinterpreting the Torah so that they match together, so that the day, whatever was created on that day, was developed in that time period in the universe. So it's concordism because he's making them tie together, making them match perfectly the science and the Torah. And this is what we talked about before. You know, this is not a crazy approach that this physicist came up with. This is the approach of the Rambam. This is the approach that the Rishonim, many of the medieval greatest philosophers took. They took the philosophy and the science of their day and age and they read it back into the Torah. They interpreted the Torah based on their philosophy and their science. So, you know, Dr. Schroeder is not coming up with some crazy idea. Let's take the science of today and read it into the Torah. That's very traditional of what he's doing. Nevertheless, there are challenges to it. And another great book, or so I've been told, I've never read it, I didn't put it up here because I haven't read it, and by Professor Natan Aviezer of Bar-Ilan University. He's written a few books. I think his first book on the subject was called In the Beginning. I've never seen it, but I've heard wonderful things about it, even better than Genesis and the Big Bang, which I did read, and I very much enjoyed. But there's a problem with concordance. Actually, quite a few problems. Or concordance. Let's put it this way. Concordism is not very popular in many circles. Concordism is not accepted by most members of the, what you could call the intellectual elite of modern Orthodoxy. Why not? So in a recent issue of Tradition, in December 2008, Dr. David Chaz is a philosophy professor at Yeshiva University. He wrote an article to address this topic. He's an analytical philosopher, and he takes it step by step, going through, it starts with the question of why is concordism challenged so much? Why isn't it accepted so readily? You have great books by Gerald Schroeder, by Nathan Aviezer, and they're just dismissed out of hand, almost. So he takes all the arguments against concordism. Let's look at a brief summary of these arguments, because it's a fascinating article. You got to sit tight throughout the whole article and read it. It's a little challenging to read it, but once you get through it, it's very rewarding. Loading up. Here we go. And I'll explain to what you mean, what they mean here. And this is from Dr. Chaz's article. Number one is, we are not privileged. And this means that all the prior generations, if you accept concordism, misunderstood the Torah. They didn't have our science, and therefore they didn't understand the Torah. And that leads to two questions. Number one, who are we to say that they were wrong? And number two, who are we to think that we deserve somehow for God to give us this information that was not available to hundreds of generations of great, righteous, and brilliant people? Why would God give it to us and not to them? Why would the Rambam not have access to this information so that he could read the Torah properly while we have it? You know, who are we to have that? Now, Dr. Chaz points out that that's not a good challenge. He has a number of reasons why it's not a good challenge, but just basically that's the nature of any finish, any new idea that any Talmud Chacham proposes. Well, how come nobody else thought of it before? Well, that's the nature of Chiddush. Ein Beis Medrash v'lo Chiddush. There's no study group without some original, unique idea. So we're allowed to propose new ideas, and Gerald Schroeder is allowed to propose his new ideas. It's a new pshat. The Rashi gave his pshat, Rashbam gave his pshat, Ibn Ezra gave his pshat, Ramban gave his pshat. Why aren't we allowed to offer pshat as well? Nechama Leibowitz did, Rabbi Ben Nun did, and who in the modern Orthodox world doesn't like at least one of them, if not both? So how come Gerald Schroeder can't offer his pshat? Okay, maybe he's not the biggest Talmud Chacham, he came to Judaism later in life. But there are other people who are big Talmudic Chachamim. Nathan Aviezer is no slouch either. Why can't he offer a pshat if Rabbi Ben Nun can? That's a pretty good response to this argument that we're not privileged. Now, the next one is that the Torah is not a science textbook, which has a lot of truth to it. You do not read the Torah in order to understand science, despite, or maybe because of what we said earlier. Maybe you could take science and read it into the Torah, but you can't look into the Torah. The Torah's goal is not to teach us science. The Torah's goal is not to teach us history. The Torah's goal is to teach us religious ideas, commandments. Right? The first Rashi in the Torah says, why didn't the Torah start with the first commandment in Parshas Bo, later in Exodus chapter 12? What happened? Why do we have all these 60 chapters before then if they don't teach us any commandments? So the Rashi struggles with that and gives an answer. But clearly what you see from there is that the Torah is about teaching religious ideas and religious commandments and religious concepts. It's not about teaching us history. It's not about teaching us science. But nevertheless, even if you take that as true, and I think that is correct, the Torah is not teaching us science, but the Torah has many levels to it. Shivim panim la Torah. There are many different levels to understand the Torah. You can understand the Torah on simple pshat. You can understand the Torah in more complicated pshat. There's drash, there's remez, there's so, there's mystical readings of the Torah. Why can't you have a science reading of the Torah? Also, there are so many different ways to read the Torah. The Torah is a very complex book written by, you know, the greatest author that could possibly be. It's the most perfect book, the most perfect author. Why can't there be a level of science in all the many levels to read Torah? So even though the Torah is not a science textbook, once you have a science, like the Rambam tried, why can't you read that science back into the Torah as one of the many levels to understand the Torah? The third argument against concordism is what Dr. Chaz called the shifting sands. I don't think he coined the term, but it's a very, very apt term. Shifting sands, meaning science is constantly changing. And we see that all the time. Someone mentioned here medical assumptions change. You know, global warming assumptions may or may not change. Who knows whether they change. You know, but certainly in the 70s or the 60s and 70s, we're talking about global cooling, and now we're talking about global warming. So we see things change very, very quickly. You know, this is probably not a good example, but it's very timely. You know, should women get mammograms? Should not women not get mammograms? Or how frequently and what age should women get mammograms? There's so many ideas that are constantly changing. So if that's the case, how can we interpret the Torah based on science? That is pretty much probably wrong. So that, Dr. Shant says, yes, but no. You should take these interpretations, Gerald Schroeder's interpretations, not Kanaviezer's interpretations, as suggestions. Maybe this is what the Torah is talking about. Now, for an example of a science changing, so at the time that Dr. Schroeder wrote his book, he assumed, based on the scientific consensus at the time, that the universe was 15 billion years old. And he had all his time frames of how long each day was and how long, you know, as they got shorter and shorter of each day, his whole time frame was based on that 15 billion years. But lately, I mean, I'm no expert, but I read this in an article maybe 2 years ago, lately the consensus had moved down from 15 billion to 12 billion years. Now, that's not much of a consolation to someone who reads the 6 days literally at 6 24-hour days. That's not much a consolation. 12 billion is still far away. But his whole time schedule doesn't work anymore. Dr. Schroeder's time frame of 15 billion doesn't work anymore because science has changed in the past 18 years to 12 billion. So what did he do with that? I haven't asked him, but I think it's simple. He would say that his whole time frame is just a suggestion, approximately. You know, this is based on the knowledge he had in 1991. This is how he would read the Torah. If the knowledge changes over time, so we'll tinker with it. We'll change it a little bit. It's a suggestion. No pshat ever offered by anyone was ever set in stone that could never be challenged. Rashi gave a pshat, and Rashbam challenged it. Ibn Ezra gave a pshat, Ramban challenged it. Does that mean Ibn Ezra cannot give a pshat? No. Even if it changes, what you're offering is a suggestion. You're putting it on the table and let people discuss it. Maybe it's right. Maybe it's close to right. But it's certainly an interesting approach. And as Dr. Shatz points out, archaeology, history, philology, their consensus opinions, they change over time also. Should we not use philology or archaeology or ancient history to understand the Torah better? Some people would say yes, but I think most of, certainly the modern Orthodox elite, would say, of course we should. And if you're going to use those, even though they change a little bit over time, you should also be using contemporary science, even if it does change over time. Let's move on. Just one other point is that even if you accept the shifting sands objection that we can't use science to understand the Torah because science is going to be changing, but you have to understand we use science in our daily lives. Certainly, if you fly in an airplane, you're accepting some sort of science. If you're using computers, you're accepting some sort of science. And even, fine, these are things that have been tested. So even if the theory behind it doesn't work, in practice it works. But we believe many things from science. And if you're going to believe it, even though you know it may be revised over time, if you're going to believe it, so why can't you interpret the Torah based on that belief, just like everyone interpreted the Torah based on their beliefs since the Torah was given thousands of years ago? So in the end, concordism doesn't work for a different reason. And the reason people don't accept it, Dr. Shatz points out at the end of his article, is what Nathan Slipkin proves in his book, and that's that all the concordist approaches that have been suggested over time to date, including Dr. Schroeder's, including Nathan Aviezer's, they don't work because they have one detail that does not work with the text, and that's the timing, the order in which creation is told in the story of Genesis does not correspond entirely to the order offered by science today. And this is something that Rabbi Slifkin goes into in detail in his book, and Mir Sishim will talk about it briefly, where he goes from there. If the concordance approaches don't work, so where do you go next? So I want to talk about some other approaches. Concordism, as we just said, is interesting, but it might not work because you have that fatal flaw of the order. But there are other approaches that are possible, and this all ties together into what I told you is my grand theory of reconciliation of Torah and science. Genesis and Jewish Thought is probably one of the most important books published recently. It's from last year, published by Ketav from Yeshiva Tarzion. And if you want to know what modern Orthodox thought is at today, where it is, what are the ideas that are prevalent and are possibly cutting edge, even if they're not prevalent yet, they will be soon. This book has it all. It's by Rabbi Chaim Navon. I think he's an Israeli who teaches in Yeshiva Tarzion. Very original thinker, very interesting thinker, and a lot in that book is fabulously interesting. Even if not original, it's really just where we are, the state of modern Orthodox thought today. So on the issue of Torah and science, he offers three different approaches. Number one is to reject science. It's wrong. Yeah, they're extrapolating from extrapolating from the present to the past, and maybe the past was different, or, you know, maybe the world was created, the universe was created looking old, those types of arguments. And there's another argument which I just want to mention because he doesn't mention it, and that's the special case argument, and that maybe science is right, but it's still wrong. For example, think of gravity the way you understood it as a kid. You pick something up, you drop it. Why? Because the world, gravity forces things towards the Earth, towards the planet. Well, the truth is that's not entirely accurate. It's true. But the truth is everything has a gravitational pull. I have a gravitational pull. This glass with water in front of me has a gravitational pull. This computer has a gravitational pull. But in relation to the planet below us, it's negligible because the planet is so much bigger and has such a larger gravitational pull. The gravitational pull between any of us, any of these small objects, is totally negligible. But when you're dealing with different planets, different stars, different galaxies, so then you have to take into account all the multiple gravitational pulls coming in from all different directions in order to calculate anything in outer space. So what we have here is we used to believe gravity was the Earth pulling things down, and what we learned was that gravity is that gravitational pull of the Earth is a special case. Really, there is an X factor out there. There are other factors where when we look at it, they're negligible, they don't really count, and that's why we didn't notice them at first. But when you look into outer space, you look at other larger things, that X factor does come into play. So maybe the science that we see today and all the different aspects, maybe there's an X factor lying out there that we just don't know about it. Everything we know is true, but it's not the whole story, and there's more to it. And then when you extrapolate back into history, or you look back at the various cases in the Torah, maybe that X factor does come into play because those aren't the cases that we see today, or for some other reason. So we always have that X factor lying out there that maybe what we see now, the science that we understand now, is correct, but it's a special case. It's another reason to reject science in some way while still accepting it. And that's going to come up later as we discuss my grand theory. And I see we're running out of time, so I'm going to move a little quicker now. So Rabbi Navon has two other approaches to dealing with this conflict between Torah and science. Number one is concordism, or really number two. Number one is reject science. Number two is concordism, which we just talked about. And number three is the both-and approach. Reinterpret anything problematic. And reinterpret allegorically if need be. And this is radical. This, if you want to see cutting edge, this is cutting edge. And the truth is I'm not entirely comfortable with this, but I'm going to show it to you anyway because I believe Rabbi Navon is an interesting and reliable source to discuss. This is a modern Orthodox view that's out there. For example, here, let me read this to you. Similarly, much ink has been spilled over the camels that are mentioned in Scripture. The book of Genesis describes our patriarchs riding camels. Scholars and rabbis have been arguing for decades about whether camels had already been domesticated in the patriarchal period. We have a conflict, not science in terms of physics, but history, ancient history. It conflicts with what we see in the Torah. So according to the position presented here, the question is totally irrelevant. Right? We reinterpret what's in the Torah radically. According to the, perhaps the patriarchs never really rode on camels, but on donkeys, or on oxen, or on winged horses, or perhaps they traveled on foot. Who cares? I'm reading this from Rabbi Navon's book. Who cares? God, for various reasons connected to the Torah's influence upon the generation in which it was given, and upon later generations, preferred to write that the patriarchs rode on camels. Now, it's not a lie. It says this in the book. I don't have it quoted here. It's not a lie. The Torah was not lying. It said camels because that had a significant impact. It was true in one sense, in a spiritual sense, in a historical sense, but not in the literal sense. If we accept this contradiction between this conflict between Torah and science, I'm not sure you have to. I don't know why he doesn't know about the Dr. Schneer Lyman wrote an article about this in the 60s already, that it's not a question. But regardless, the camels, so you can reinterpret anything in the Torah. This is his tool of reinterpreting, allegorizing, or taking it out of literal translation and making it more general so that it doesn't conflict with history, it doesn't conflict with science. Here's another example. I found this quite radical also. This is from, I believe, it's he calls it Y. Rosenstein. I believe it's Yisrael Rosenstein from an article he wrote. From this perspective, it is not the archaeological presence of the wall surrounding Jericho. Studies of Jericho seem to imply that there was no wall around it that collapsed. So, it is not the archaeological presence of the wall that is important, and it makes no difference whether we are dealing with an actual wall or with a city that was protected in some other manner. The point is that the wall symbolizes the significant urban settlement that faced the nomadic people. Allegorize the wall. There was a wall around Jericho that fell. Well, maybe the wall symbolizes something, symbolizes urban settlement. And when that fell, it really means the urban settlement dissolved, disintegrated somehow. So it wasn't a literal wall. So if, and it's not clear that it does, but if the archaeological record conflicts with what we see in the book of Yehoshua, so he allegorizes or reads non-literally the problematic or the difficult verse. And in that, with that tool, you can get around just about everything. And he quotes other people who do this, Rav Kook, Rav Mordechai Breuer. There's a conflict between conventional history and Talmudic history. So Rav Mordechai Breuer also, to some degree, allegorizes the Talmudic basis of the history to solve and resolve that problem of Talmudic chronology. And really, you could do it to almost everything except where we have fundamental faith. And at that point, you can't move on beyond that. And what's a fundamental faith? Well, we're not going to talk about that right now because we have less than 10 minutes left. Okay, let's quickly talk about Rabbi Sliskin before I get to my grand theory of reconciling. So Rabbi Sliskin, as we said, he rejects concordism. He rejects the approaches that reject science, the idea that the universe is created looking old. He pokes a lot of holes in that. You know, I had always thought I could count on that in my back pocket. Maybe God created the universe looking old. After reading Rabbi Sliskin's chapter, I'm not comfortable at all with that theory, because I think there are very serious theoretical problems with that. So Rabbi Sliskin has said he allegorizes. Like we said above, like Rabbi Navon concludes, so that's how Rabbi Sliskin really does that. He allegorizes creation, and he finds the theological meaning in the days of creation. So that is true. But they're not really days. The days of creation were not really literal days. Instead, they relate to aspects of the creation, and I can't give this justice in less than 10 minutes, but certainly if you read his book, you'll find it there. But he also finds a lot of the entire story of creation. He comes up with five main theological ideas. Number one, God created the universe. Number two, God is the creator of everything in the universe. Number three, the world is good. Right? God looked and he saw that all creation was good each day. And man is the pinnacle, the goal of creation. After all the creation, finally, at the end of the sixth day, God creates man because he's the pinnacle. And creation is consecrated by Shabbos. These are the five main theological ideas. But Rabbi Sliskin goes further and goes into some of the details and points out some very interesting ideas theologically on the truth of the story of creation without needing it to be literal day by day, what was created in 6 days, whether it's 24-hour days or millions or billions of years of days. He sees it as an allegory. Now let me move on to my grand theory. I call this a toolbox approach. And there are two sides to this. There's a science toolbox and there's the religion toolbox. From the science toolbox, you have to recognize the shifting sands. Not everything in science is true, and we can't jump to every latest theory of science and try to and just accept it out of hand, out of pocket, because it could very well be not true. It could, in 10 years, we could find out that it's not true. In less time, we could find out it's not true. Things are moving so quickly today. There is a shifting sands, and there could be an X factor sitting out there. Who knows whether what we see now is a special case, and that when you realize, when we learn about that X factor, which could take 100 years till we know about that X factor, and you generalize beyond the special case that we see now, everything could change. So you have to have a certain amount of skepticism of science, not in the sense that you don't believe it, but you're not 100% sure about it. Because there could be a special case, and there could be an overturn. Some things are pretty proven, right? Gravity's proven. It's not going to change anytime soon that when I drop something, it's going to fall to the floor. But there's a special, that's a special case, and it could be generalized. It could perhaps be generalized even more. Evolution has been pretty well established, despite what you might hear. I think it's been pretty well established, but it could just be a special case, and it could be there are other ways of getting around that also, which we don't have to talk about right now, but it could be a special case, and it could be generalized. You could find a generalization beyond that. On the other hand, from the Torah perspective, we have a toolbox of different approaches, and some of those approaches you take out when appropriate. You could read things non-literally. You could take a concordance approach, like the Rambam, unlike Gerald Schroeder and Nathan Aviezer. Sometimes science can be read into Torah, even if it's not creation, the other parts of the Torah, where science can be read very well into it. And sometimes you can allegorize. You know, Rabbi Navon and Rabbi Sufkin gave us powerful examples of how to allegorize, and even if you're not 100% comfortable with them, and I have to say I'm not 100% comfortable with everything Rabbi Navon said and everything Rabbi Sufkin has said, that's my own personal comfort level based on where I came from. It is enough. I have enough confidence in that approach that I can have it in my back pocket. I know it's in my toolbox. And whenever I come across a scientific challenge to the Torah, I know in my toolbox I have various approaches, and one of them is that allegorizing approach. So if I want to spend a year studying a topic in depth and trying to reconcile that particular challenge with the Torah, so I can take out my toolbox and pick out each of the tools and see which work and which don't work, and maybe I'll have to resort to Rabbi Sifkin's and Rabbi Navon's approach of allegorizing, and maybe I won't have to resort to that. Maybe there are other ways, and maybe there are multiple ways of doing it. Let me just make a point that some of the critics of Rabbi Sifkin point out, that Rabbi Sadia Gaon said that you can only allegorize a portion in Torah if you're forced to do it by science, by reason, and by philosophy. So some people say, well, maybe evolution hasn't been sufficiently proven to force us to it. There are serious scientists who debate evolution, so maybe we're not forced to, if we were literally forced, if it was proven in a laboratory that evolution is correct, so then we have Rabbi Sadia Gaon, and we can allegorize the creation story. But since we're not forced to do it, so maybe Rabbi Sifkin is overstepping his boundaries, maybe Rabbi Navon is overstepping his boundaries. And number one, what Rabbi Sadia Gaon meant by forced is different than what we mean by forced. He believed philosophy could force you to allegorize the Torah. Philosophy cannot be proven in a laboratory. Philosophy cannot be proven in a foolproof way, and the proof of that, it was disproven. The philosophy that Rabbi Sadia Gaon believed in was disproven, at least some of it, major portions of it, even by the Rambam, and certainly by later, and then where we are today. But still, he allowed that. Even something that was not 100% proven irrefutably can still be used to allegorize the Torah. But even beyond that, Rabbi Sifkin has Rabbi Cook to rely on. I don't have the quote for you here in front of me, but it's quoted in Rabbi Navon's book, that Rabbi Cook said, you don't have to prove science in order to allegorize the Torah. Once you have a scientific challenge, you're free to allegorize the Torah within the parameters of the 13 fundamental principles of belief. But still, you're free to allegorize it even if it hasn't been proven. And that's something I keep in my toolbox. Whenever I see a challenge, it doesn't bother me. Why not? Because I know I have all these tools, both on the science side and on the religion side, in which I can approach the topic. We ran out of time, but if anyone has any questions now, please feel free to type them in. I'll stay on for at least 10 minutes. And again, I want to thank everybody who came on and who listened and sat through all this. And I'm more than happy to hear any questions, which you can type in now, and I'll give you my email address so you can email to me if we don't have time tonight to discuss it. So thank you very much, and let the questions begin. Oh, sorry, you couldn't hear anything I just said. Okay, let me start again. Someone asked a question before, which I missed, I didn't understand, and now I do understand. What about medical assumptions that were proven incorrect, meaning medical assumptions in the Talmud, such as Mesubin? Mesubin, now I understand what he meant, is when you lean at the Pesach Seder, the Passover Seder, you have to lean to the left, the Gemara says. Why? So that the food doesn't go down the wrong pipe, because of the way the esophagus is, not the esophagus, the flap. My biology is very outdated. I can't remember anything from high school or college. The flap is. The flap, it'll let the food go down the windpipe, and that'll cause you to choke. That's why you have to lean to the left, so that it won't go down the windpipe. Now, when I learned that in Gemara, when I learned that in Yeshiva, so I went to the library, took out a Gray's Anatomy, which is a standard anatomical textbook, and I looked it up, and I spent a lot of time, and it seems to me that was wrong. The whole way the flap works, it doesn't make any difference if you lean to the left, that won't help in any way. Really, the flap goes the other way, but even then, it's not such a big deal. So I went and I asked Rabbi Moshe David Tendler, who is a biology professor at Yeshiva University, and he's also Rosh Yeshiva, and he told me the Gemara is correct. Why? He gave me an answer, which, chaval, I don't remember what he said. I wish I did. I'm not 100% certain that what he said was correct. And in theory, if it really was a danger, I would personally recommend that you lean the other way, if it really was a danger. But look, I don't think it's really a danger either way. Truth is, when it's not Pesach, I eat in all sorts of ways, standing on my head. Well, not standing on my head, but, you know, leaning on the bed, you lying down, whatever. I never had any problems with that. So do I lean to the left? Yes. Why? I'm not going to say not to. I'm not going to change that after so many years. Was the Gemara correct about the anatomy? If you look in the Rishonim, you can find a different approach to understanding it. Maybe, yeah, I think there's a Rashi and Rashbam. I don't remember off the top of my head, but I believe there are other ways of understanding the Gemara. Lean to the left. What do you have to lose? There's also another example for eating meat and dairy. So the Gemara says it's dangerous. So that's why we don't eat meat. I'm sorry, not meat and dairy. That's the Torah, certainly meat and Rabbanan. Meat and fish. So the Gemara says it's dangerous. You can't eat meat and fish. So is it really dangerous? You see people all the time eating meat and fish, non-Jews, and it's not a problem. So there is such an opinion in the Magen Avraham that it's no longer a danger and it's totally mutter. And I believe Dr. Fred Rosner had an article about this in Tradition a few years ago. Do you really need to? So we just keep it for tradition, if for no other reason. There is a basis to change the halacha based on that, which the Magen Avraham says, but it's not really standard, so why be different? I've never seen anyone, the question is, has anyone attempted to allegorize Mount Sinai, the giving of Torah at Mount Sinai? I've never seen that. I don't think it's possible. I don't think you can allegorize the Exodus. I don't think you can allegorize the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai. I think certainly allegorizing the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai contradicts the Rambam's eighth fundamental principle of Judaism. But I've never seen anybody try to do it, and I don't think that would... A lot of the things they already say makes me uncomfortable. That would certainly make me double uncomfortable, what I've already seen. Okay, with that, I'll say goodnight to everybody. I'll sign off. And I will, Amir Hashem, see you back here next week. Oh, I see someone's typing, so I'll let him finish. Okay, thanks. You're welcome, and thank you very much, everybody. Have a good night.